This is Fundraising Radio, and today's a guest speaker. We have Nirman Dave, co-founder and CEO at Obviously AI, that closed their most recent round right before coronavirus. And this episode, we'll talk mostly about raising money from scouts, raising money during coronavirus, and also we will focus on scouts because part of their most recent round was funded by Sequoia Scouts. And also, closer to the end of the episode, we'll discuss how to plan the pricing tiers for the customers before you even have traction. So Nirman, I'll let you kick off by you giving us some background on yourself and on Obviously AI.
Yeah, so thanks for having me, Constantine, really appreciate it. I'm Nirman. I grew up in India and kind of ended up starting a company in India. It was called Circuitrix, which we really scaled very well. From there on, I ended up at a small liberal arts college near Boston called Hampshire, moved to San Francisco, and then started Obviously AI. As a quick kind of background, Obviously AI is a no-code machine learning tool for business users. So anyone that has never coded before, never written machine learning or Python code before, can actually take a historical data set about their business, about their customers, and predict something out of it. So that's really what Obviously enables people to do. As a company, we're fairly young. We started about a year and a half back. And since then, we've grown from two people in a basement to 12 people today. We worked with 1,500 small, medium businesses and a couple of large enterprises as well. So that's kind of, quick and dirty overview about us.
That's a decent interview. I mean, that's a decent overview. I'll use my language here. But speaking of starting as, two people in the basement, when was the time that you've decided that, it's time to grow the team, it's time to go out and raise money from investors?
So I was actually working at a company in San Francisco, and I was the only data science person at the company, right? So everyone would come up to me and they would ask me questions around regression, classification. I would often see analysts at my company trying to learn simple concepts in machine learning from YouTube videos, and they would fail miserably at it. So that's, where the light bulb went up, and it said, why is it that these non-tech business users, they're the ones who know the business, they're the ones who know the data, why is it that they are spending hours and hours of their day trying to learn something that's super technical heavy? So that's where the idea of Obviously AI started. Can we build a machine learning tool that enables anyone to quickly run their algorithms and run predictions on the data set that they have? So I started to work on that, got a couple of beta users. A friend of mine who just moved from MIT was working at another company in SF. We both kind of were living together, and we started to kind of see ourselves working on this every day after we came back from our job. At one point, we learned that the only way we can kind of build something that's more robust is focusing on it full time. So we both decided to quit our jobs. We had, I think, $6,000 each. So we had $18,000 each. We paid our rent for a couple of months, and we knew we were going to quickly run out of money if we didn't raise, right? And we were still kind of building our product. So as immigrants that had come from India and other places in the world, and as students, that were kind of navigating from the school lifestyle to the work lifestyle, we were at this phase where we had a product, we had a couple of beta users, and we said, hey, for us to actually grow and focus on this, we have to raise, and we ended up doing that.
That's really cool. And I imagine that at this point when you were just, realizing that you will run out of money soon if you don't raise, so you were basically forced to raise. And I imagine that at that point you didn't really have any traction nor a good MVP, right?
Right.
And how do you go with investors? How long did it take you basically to raise that first round when you were pre-revenue, pre-product?
It was a very difficult time because every time we build something, so one thing to understand about a tool like this is it's very complicated to build, especially when you're kind of trying to build something like machine learning for someone that's non-technical. And because of the complexities that it has, every time we said, okay, we've completely built a tool and it's going to work perfectly fine from now, we went to a customer and the customer sat there clueless about what to do. And then we had to come back, we had to redesign it, we had to kind of re-engineer some things and go back. And we went through that process so many different times. So there was this very difficult time where we were kind of expecting a lot of rejection from customers because the product was kind of half-baked. And then we went to investors, and interestingly enough, one of the good things about Silicon Valley investors is they're very excited to hear about new ideas. They have very interesting thoughts about that as well. So that worked out very well for us because it was a hot topic, it was a hot market, and people wanted to listen more about what we were doing. So we got a lot of investor meetings. Raising out first time, we often, didn't have a very clear picture of the product roadmap. We were just building something to solve a problem. We didn't know how it's going to scale. We didn't know what the market was. And so as we started to talk to investors, we started to learn about what are some of the things that they really care about. So what are the things that they care about in the product? What are the things that they care about in the market? And how can we better understand those things as we fundraise? So in a way, that worked out very well for us is because not only did we end up fundraising, by the way, our first investment came from Skydeck, which is an accelerator based out of Berkeley. But not only did we end up fundraising, but we also learned a lot about our own business in the process. I think that was one of the most exciting things. We actually blundered a lot of fundraise. We were talking to investors, and there were questions we didn't know answer to, so we tried to make them up on the spot, and we blundered those things. So,
Right.
learned a lot of things about, interacting with people, how they perceive businesses and the risks, things like that. So that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting, but also raising pre-product pre-revenue is super extra complicated. And I'm curious, do you target some specific investors to reach out to? So was there like a specific persona that you were trying to reach, like I know founders who maybe sold their companies that were focused on AI or something like that, or do you just reach out to whoever you found?
So we were pretty overwhelmed. When we started working on this company, just like as kind of any immigrant trying to start a company in the US, one of the key things that was on the back of our head was, can we find an investor that can, help us figure out how to do this, right? We had no clue, how to kind of build a company, how to set up the infrastructure, all of that. So we started with looking for investors that could do that. Very quickly we learned that you don't need an investor that can help you do that. You need an investor that can help you grow the business, and things like the logistics part is very easy to handle. So we started looking at investors that were specifically investing in outside founders, but then we quickly realized that the logistics thing can be easy. So we started to look at all the early stage investors that people typically talk about. So we would apply to accelerators like YC, we would apply to accelerators like Berkeley Skydeck, which is the one that we ended up taking up. So we looked at the accelerator, the path. The way it really all started was there's a company in San Francisco, and one of the founders suggested that the best way to get started is kind of jump into an accelerator, because they'll kind of help you understand the landscape, they'll help you understand the processes, and how to kind of get your first few customers, right? So we started to apply to a bunch of accelerators, and eventually that's kind of what we ended up taking.
Right, that's actually a really good path and probably the most realistic path for pre-product, pre-revenue. So whoever is listening to this, if you don't have a product yet nor revenue, accelerators, incubators, and venture studios is definitely a place for you to go to. So let's skip forward to the second round that you've raised. And part of that round you've raised from Sequoia Scouts. Can you go a little bit in depth into this? How did this happen? How did you get in touch with them?
So kind of just to kind of add to the previous part, I don't think we were fully pre-product. We were pre-revenue, but I think one of the key things that actually helped our process with the accelerators was the fact that we could show something, and that we could show the fact that we have enough commitment and drive that we are actually building out things and we're testing it, which actively really helped us in the process. If we were pre-product, if we had no beta product, no beta users, I'm not sure how that would have gone. So I think there's definitely a lot of value in kind of making sure you have a product and a user. It really just shows how you are mature as a founder. but talking about the next round, the next round was pretty exciting. We actually did kind of start thinking about that after the accelerator. We kind of took some time to kind of build out the product, get more customers, get more paid customers. Although we were kind of early on where we would do a lot of paid pilots, we weren't still kind of closing full length customers. We're doing paid pilots with large enterprises. And I think there the goal was to kind of really, you know, figure out the best kind of messaging market fit, which means what's the best kind of messaging you can tell to the right kind of people, and figure out the best kind of customer fit. So that was really the goal of our next raise. But I was working at a company that was Sequoia funded before I started, obviously. Yeah. So I had a really good relationship with the founder, and you know, he didn't really jump right into investment, but actually after we had the product, after we had the users, he saw the commitment that I had, he saw the fact that we were pulling through, and then decided to invest. So I think, you know, I think we briefly touched on this before, but the difference between just any angel and a scout is typically that a scout still has accountability to other people. So they'll have to, even if they love the product, they'll have to kind of back it with a really good foundation and a reason. Whereas an angel can just, you know, if they like it, they'll just put money in you. So I think that's the little bit of a difference that we see there. But I think overall that's how it came to be.
So basically, you got an introduction to Sequoia Scouts, right?
Sorry, say that one more time.
So you actually got basically introduced to those Sequoia Scouts. They did not reach out to you themselves, or you didn't reach out to them?
No, so we actually, so he was my boss in my previous company.
Mm-hmm.
So we always had this working relationship. When I left the job, I had a conversation with him that, hey, you know, this is what I want to do, and I'm moving forward on this path. And he actually deeply appreciated it and respected that. He was a founder who had done similar startups and had been on the path before. So he really knew what it means to kind of work on a startup. So I think he was very supportive from early on. The investment came when we grew at a certain limit, right? So the investment didn't come right away, but it came from him when we grew. So I think it was just a product of the fact that we had this relationship. We kept it even after the job, and that he was also deeply invested in kind of the work that I was doing. And you know, having worked together, he also was very, very supportive of all the other things I did.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So let's go back to both of those rounds that you raised. And I'm curious, what's your major takeaway? So was there some specific strategy that maybe worked best for you specifically? Maybe that was, I don't know, just basically reaching out to everyone on Crunchbase, or reaching out to everyone who left some, I don't know, comments on some VC's posts on Twitter, or what was that? Was there some sort of strategy that really worked out for you?
So I think, I'll tell you about the very first accelerated round, right? And the fact that we got into Berkeley was kind of close to a miracle or something, I would say. So here's how it happened, right? The Berkeley Skydeck Accelerator applications had closed, and we were kind of applying left and right to as many accelerators as we can, because that's the only way we knew to move forward. So we were applying left and right to accelerators. Berkeley Skydeck application had closed, and we actually emailed the info at email, actually saying, hey, I know the accelerator applications have closed, but can you make us an exception? And we got two responses. One person, you know, said, the applications are closed, you know, we can't do anything, come next year. And the other response said, hey, sure, why don't you send over your deck? And we totally ignored the first response, and we just and we sent over our deck. And the next thing you know, we were in the process. You know, they asked us to fly down to Berkeley. We were in Boston at the time, and we moved to Berkeley. We did a presentation with them, and I think a day later, we knew we were in. So I think that's kind of how it worked out very well. The only thing is to really kind of just ask. I think that's something that I've learned very early on, is not only about fundraising, but a lot of just other things, is just the ability to ask. It's just so powerful and so underrated that sometimes if something is not possible, the fact that you can ask and be like, hey, can you make me an exception? Or hey, is there still a chance this could happen? I think that is very, very important. So that played out pretty well for us. I think that was super helpful. When it came to the other rounds, I think the way we got introduced to a lot of institutional investors early on was through our accelerator. So they connected us with a lot of different funds, one of which was Arca Ventures, which ended up investing in us, and a bunch of different kind of angels as well. So they made these intros and connections. They actually do this thing where they kind of curate a list of investors for you and for your business and try to kind of connect you with them. But the real goal as a founder there is that you get this wave of investors that want to meet with you because the market is hot, because what you're doing is interesting. So I think one of the key things there is to understand and learn, right, where these investors are coming from. I mean, at the end of the day, everyone's human, so it's very important to be a little empathetic, I feel like, and really understand what is their perspective about the market. What are their biases about the market? Maybe they like a particular type of approach in a product, then they don't like the other one. What are their benchmarks that they want to see? I think these kind of things were really, really important as we started to talk to investors. And it really helped us narrow down kind of how we want to move forward. For example, if you have enough revenue, but probably not a high amount of revenue, which where kind of most startups end up at after a few accelerator rounds, is then it's a good idea to target investors that are investing in companies that are earlier than you, right? So what we did was we were at a point right after the accelerator. We had spent a lot of time building the product. We hadn't hit a really good revenue goal at the moment, and instead of targeting investors that were investing in large revenue rounds, we started to target investors that were investing with no revenue expectation. And so because of that, what would happen is we would get much more interesting leads, and the fact that we were already high revenue generating in the companies that they would typically see worked out well for us. So really important to understand, what are the companies that an investor is going to see on an everyday basis? A pre-seed investor is not going to see the same companies that a Series A investor or Series B investor is going to see on everyday basis, and they're not going to be tracking the same kind of companies that the larger investors will be. So it's very important to kind of understand where you are in that place and target people that typically don't see the type of companies that are you, which might just give you a big boost. So that's something that I've personally observed.
Right. So you mentioned revenue, and that's the next topic that I want to discuss today with you. I'm looking at your pricing plans here, and I'm honestly not sure how did you come up with this pricing plan? So your first tier is free, so $0 per month, and the next one is 75. So how did you come up with those like first two tiers?
That's a great question, actually. I think from the start, it was very hard for us to kind of come up with an interesting pricing. Because part of the reason was when you're going to larger companies and selling a tool like this that they've never really seen before, they don't know how to compare this tool with something else, right? So pricing can be very difficult, because there's no point of anchor, right? There's nothing that people know where to start with. So we did a lot of experimentation with our pricing. We had a tier that went from free to $1,000 a month. We had a different tier, so on and so forth. So we did a lot of experimentation there, and eventually we started to learn what are some of the key things that our users care about. And very quickly we learned that the users don't care about building the machine learning model as much as they care about taking action on that model. So a lot of the pricing that we built is kind of built to focus on the action piece. So if you want to just go ahead and build a model, you can go ahead and do that on the free plan. But the moment you want to take an action on it, you want to kind of use that model to kind of put it inside your workflow, connect with Zapier or something like that. That's when we start charging you. So I think that's something that we eventually learned and kind of settled into. Pricing is an answer that we typically don't get early on. But it's something that we only learn from customers.
Now let's speak about customers then, because acquiring the first customers is probably the most, the hardest thing that you do in the startup world. So how do you manage to do this? How do you acquire your first like 10 or 100 customers?
So when I quit my job, I asked my boss, "Hey, by the way, do you know anyone that does, analytics work? Besides your company, besides the company that we worked at." And he said, "Hey, I know this other guy in this other company. He's my friend who is an analyst." I'm like, "Great, connect me." So I think that was like the very first starting point, and this was even before we had a product. So just kind of getting those connections was super helpful. I think your first customers always typically come from your own network. And then, people talk about it, and then you get a community on Twitter, which is what happened to us. And people really, really get excited about the things that you do. But the very early customers came from our own network. That was kind of the first wave of customers. The second wave of customers was from the network of the accelerator that we were in. So Skydeck had connections of previous Skydeck companies, of partners that they were working with, things like that. And those connections became super helpful. And it took us a while. I think in 2019, we started to kind of build out what we call our content strategy. And that really helped us build a recognition among people that would talk about us, that would recommend us to other folks, things like that. But before we had all of that, it was just our network.
So here, we're gonna move from the discussing your past basically to discussing your future, which is the acquisition. I'm curious, what's your view on that? So do you think founders should plan for the acquisition like really early on? Should they show their investors in a pitch deck like, here are the five cust I mean the five companies that we believe might acquire our company in 5 years? Do you think that makes sense?
So typically, I think I mean, this is my personal opinion, is that as founder, you're starting a company not because you want to start a company, but because you strongly feel about a problem that deeply resonates with you. Like, for example, automating machine learning deeply resonated with me because, like, all these analysts at my company that were bugging me, and they were taking me away from my job of what I was actually supposed to do. And so it was really annoying for me, and I wanted to really like just focus on my job and let them do their thing. So I think it really starts from that point of I want to build something that I can really, really solve, and I really think can help people. So no founder really starts with the idea that I want to build something that can get acquired. There are certain companies that might do that. We've seen companies would be a spin-off from a large enterprise, and then they would sell back to that enterprise, things like that. But I personally feel that the key focus should be on solving a problem that people deeply like. One thing that kind of helps help me is we've had several acquisition offers in the past, and as we ended up declining pretty much all of them. And as we kind of navigated through that process, one of the things that kind of helped me was one of our advisors said that it could be that they're acquiring for you for $100 million or $0, for example, or like $0, right? Whatever. What we need to really think is this a company that I can build to be a $1 billion company, something that we can really solve problems for people in the future? And how much passionate am I to build this company? So as a founder, the often one of the most important decisions you make is, do you want to sell this company out and focus on your next other thing? Or are you so passionate about the market itself that you can continue building regardless of the offers today and really, really kind of win in this market? And if the answer is the latter, where you think you can continue building and really win in this market, and you have that empathy and that connection with the people that you're building it for, I think acquisition kind of goes out of the window, regardless of how big the check size is. If you feel that that is not what you want to do, and you just want to move on with your life and figure out the next thing you want to build, that is also completely fine. And in that case, an acquisition makes sense. But on the latter case, which is what I strongly feel is we can build this our product and really, really nail down this market, I don't think acquisition makes sense at an early stage.
Right, that does make a lot of sense, and that's something that everyone should take really personally. So take time to think about this stuff. So now from the future, we're going back to the past, just jumping back and forth in time here. But my question was, if you could travel in time and go to the very first fundraising that you had for obviously AI, what would you change? Would you maybe change the pitch deck, or maybe the way that you approached investors, or the way you talk to them? Would there be something specific that you would love to change?
Oh boy. I think as like a first-time founder that kind of starts off in Silicon Valley, right? He could have been a founder in another place, which is what was the case with me, but the entire ecosystem and the environment was very different, right? So when you're in Silicon Valley, one of the key things is I think there's just this way of when you talk to some investors, you might feel that the investors have very strong opinions about the product and the market. And as you talk to them, you might start to feel that they know more than you do, even if the only thing they've done is look at your pitch deck for 5 minutes, right? You've worked on it for years and months. And you might feel like that. So what one thing that happened with us was early on, we were talking to an investor and we said, hey, we're building this tool that can help you run predictions on a data set. And they said, what about a tsunami that comes in? Will you be able to predict that? And we were like, hell no, we're not God, right? We're just predicting from the data. And then he made this insanely convincing argument about why it's important to do that. And as a founder that you're just starting off, you just have a couple of beta users, you don't have really a lot of feedback to rely on, you start to feel, oh, maybe that's the right thing to do, right? And then we started to think in the direction of building something in that sense, and it's really complicated. But I think what really helps early on is having a focus. I think where even if an investor says that, hey, this is what you should be building, knowing the fact that the investor is not the one that's on the ground 24/7, knowing the fact that they don't understand your customers the way you do, and knowing the fact that you have experienced this product firsthand, you work with the customers firsthand, so what you should be building comes from a place of focus. So when you can reject an idea from an investor that's about your product, I think that really says a lot about you as a founder. And I think that is being the most important kind of learning from the early investor raise, right? Where we ended up kind of going into the spiral where we followed everything that an investor wanted to build, thinking they're going to be investing in us, and very quickly we realized, we should not focus on that at all, and just focus on what our customers really care about. So I think that was an important learning. Like everyone tells you this thing, but you only realize it when it happens to you, and you only have to take that step back and be like, oh my God, I'm going into the spiral of building something for people that are not my customers, and just taking a step back.
Right. That's actually wonderful advice. I've seen way too many people being like super submissive to investors and like listening to their advice. Of course, investors do give advice. I mean, great advice because we've seen tons and tons of companies in all different fields. But still, your point is really great here. Just listen to your customer, not to the goddamn investor, unless your customer is the investor, and that happens too. So let's move to the last question of today's episode, which is a call to action. What's that one thing that the listener should do as soon as the episode is over?
I'm sorry, say it one more time. What's the one?
What's the one thing that the listener should do as soon as the episode is over? So, like, call to action for the listener who listened to this episode right now.
I think just kind of I think just kind of focus on like building something for your users. One other thing you should all do, by the way, is go to obviously.ai and check out our product and give it a shot. It's one of those things I had to say it. But I think overall, just focus on the product. I think it's something that we learned early on. I think the more better the product you have, it really works well. Especially if you're building a product that's aimed at a large group of people. It's very important to nail down the experience of the product, which really can impact how people feel and convert at the end of the day.
Right, that's great advice and decent call to action. I'll definitely leave a link to obviously .ai in the description of this episode. And my personal call to action would be go to the description of the episode. I will leave another link to the event that me and Make It Studio are organizing together. It's called Student Start Battle. It's basically a no BS conference where we'll discuss a step-by-step approach to solving, I mean, to bringing an idea from bringing just an idea to being a fundable company. So if you're tired of, experts telling you, to get out of the building or stuff like that, definitely join the conference that we're organizing because it can be no BS. So we'll wrap it up here. Thanks a lot, Nirman, for coming up and for sharing your knowledge, for sharing your great advice, especially on the customer focus. I think that's really helpful, and a lot of people still ignore that. So thank you for that, and have a great day.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.